Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the Secretary of State John Kerry's meeting in Paris with top Saudi, Emirati and Jordanian diplomats ahead of a meeting in Saudi Arabia with King Abdullah on Friday. Ramzi Mardini, who served in the office of the National Security Advisor to the Vice President and on the Iraq desk at the State Department's Bureau of Near East Affairs, joins us to discuss the stunning success of ISIS in Iraq that has deeply unnerved the Jordanian regime that now has the terrorist organization on its borders with Syria and Iraq, which also has the authoritarian Sunni monarchs in the Gulf reconsidering their support for jihadist radicals and concerned about a possible rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran. Then, as Tea Party Republicans move to shut down the Export-Import Bank that was created early in FDR's New Deal, we will speak with Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation and author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We'll discuss his article at Politico, Why Big Business Fears the Tea Party, and the ideological inconsistency of the populist right, who oppose crony capitalism and the Export-Import Bank for subsidizing U.S. manufacturers while supporting agricultural subsidies and the military-industrial complex, as well as the hypocrisy of their backers like the Koch brothers, who have applied for Ex-Im loans. And joining us now from the UK is Ramzi Mardini, who is a non-resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Based in Amman, Jordan, he is also an adjunct fellow at the Beirut-based Iraq Institute for Strategic Studies and was previously a Middle East analyst at the Center for Strategic Studies at the University of Jordan. From 2010 to 2011, he served at the White House within the Office of the National Security Advisor to the Vice President, and in 2006 on the Iraq desk at the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. He is the editor of Volatile Landscape, Iraq and its Insurgent Movements, and The Battle for Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and the Struggle for Stability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ramzi Mardini.
Thank you for having me.
And today, the news on Thursday is that, first of all, President Obama has asked Congress for $500 million for the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. And then the other piece of news, somewhat more surreal, I take it, is that Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Maliki has asked Russia and Belarus for jet fighters, which he says are on the way and will arrive in a couple of days. And he blames the Americans for ISIS's lightning blitzkrieg through Iraq because the U.S. sort of dawdled on delivering, he used the word they were long-winded about delivering their jets. So it doesn't sound as if, first of all, these jets, presumably they will have Russian or Belarusian pilots, will do the trick. But Maliki seems to see this as the panacea.
The situation in Iraq is not exactly what you've been hearing in the media in terms of its origins or its the solutions to solve it. I would say that the origins have actually very little to do with Nouri al-Maliki. This is because Maliki is not necessarily the problem. He's actually a symptom of the problem. So whether you remove him or not, it's not exactly going to make the situation better. In fact, I would say that if you were to remove him, because Iran is this sort of the king of the kingmakers in Iraq, what you will end up doing is actually getting an alternative that is even more pro-Iranian than al-Maliki. As for the $500 million to the Syrian opposition, I would say that the Obama administration actually does not have its policy in line with its interests in both theaters, Iraq and Syria. This is because it actually has a contradiction within its policy. There are two sides actually conflicting with each other. One is that they are seeking regime change on one hand. The other is that they're seeking a diplomatic settlement. So you have sort of one side actually undermining the effectiveness of the other. With the case of Iraq, what the United States has been doing with Iraq for the past, certainly since we left, and certainly since, you know, during the surge, is that there has been sort of an overdrive on the securitization of the U.S.-Iraq partnership, where the U.S. is actually invested in the military realm of things rather than the economic or the cultural or the institutional or the political. It sort of sees as its leverage hinging on U.S. military sales to Iraq. And what this has done, the byproduct of this, is actually a regime that is more authoritarian, because what the United States does not understand is it's not necessarily propping up the government of Iraq. It's propping up the regime in Iraq. And it has to see whose sole purpose is survive and thrive at the expense of other political factions. So in turn, over time, this has sort of led to Maliki's sort of the prime minister of Iraq, his unwillingness to compromise because of his inflated confidence that the United States and Iran both support him. And it has also undermined the political process in Iraq because there is no reason for power sharing to ever take hold.
But have we reached a point, though, Ramzi Mardini, where all of the politicians, whether it's our side, Iran, Iraq, whatever, they're all whistling past the graveyard? Aren't conditions on the ground changing? The Kurds are more or less indicating that they're moving ahead on their own in a different direction. And you get the feeling that this roiling mess in the middle of Iraq, known as the Sunni area, is obviously it's got. The Jordanians incredibly worried, and Secretary of State Kerry met in Paris on Thursday with top Saudi, Emirati, and Jordanian diplomats ahead of his meeting with King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia on Friday. Apparently, the Jordanians are worried that now two of their borders are open to terrorist infiltration from ISIS, the one with Syria and the one with Iraq. And, of course, the Sunni monarchs in the Gulf are concerned about, first of all, I don't know how much they're recognizing that their support for the jihadist radicals is backfiring, and they're also, I believe, worried about a rapprochement with the U.S. and Iran. So I've given you a whole bunch of things there, so take them one at a time.
You're absolutely right. So what's happening in Iraq is sort of a confluence of factors. You cannot drive it from solely the spillover from the Syrian civil war or the prime minister of Iraq's belligerent and authoritarian behavior. You cannot sort of pin it on either of those cases. It has been an ongoing buildup of different factors that have sort of metastasized over the years. Ever since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and obviously the unraveling of the Ba'athist state's institutions. So this has been a consequence of basically American foreign policy 2003 and onwards. It's not necessarily a recent phenomenon that people look at or perceive as coming from the Syrian civil war. I would say the Syrian civil war has magnified things, but those primary conditions which have been driving this crisis have been there since the start. You know, the United States no longer is an occupying power. And also, by the way, its decline of influence began well before its troop withdrawal commenced. For many years, the U.S. has been reacting to events in Iraq rather than shaping them. And during the largest troop presence in Iraq, Washington was still not able to pressure Baghdad to conform to its desires, let alone to force Iraq's elites to work out their politics and settle their disputes. So the decline of influence is not necessarily a function of the amount of troops we have in Iraq. It's actually a function of Iraq's deepening patronage politics. In other words, its political space has been saturated by so many actors and interests that we no longer have the ability to actually control the outcome. In other words, how can the United States do anything really effectively when it has a faction of the solution? It doesn't necessarily have the ability to control events or shape events on the ground.
And I guess that would explain the statistic that something like 80% of Iraq's budget simply disappears in corruption.
Well, 80% of Iraq's budget is actually just salaries.
Right. I see. So, again, that's patronage, right? Or corruption. Just before we get to the nervousness in Jordan and the concerns that with the Gulf Emiratis meeting with the Secretary of State Kerry ahead of his trip to Saudi Arabia on Friday, what's happening there in terms of, my understanding is that this Shia crescent that has manifested since the invasion of Iraq is also a part of the vital supply line that Iran has to both Syria and to Hezbollah. And has this situation interrupted that supply line? Or I'm told that if that supply line is cut, that's a red line for Iran and they will escalate their involvement.
You're talking about the Aura flights through Iraq's airspace.
Right.
So, John Kerry had met with Maliki in March 2013 to try to get Maliki to stop the Aura flights. Unfortunately, what the Secretary of State did not understand is that it's not necessarily Iran's pressure that's doing this. It's actually in Maliki's own political interest to have Iran use its airspace to prop up Assad's government in Syria. Because what Maliki is concerned about is that the fall of Assad would basically lead to the fall of his regime. So there's every instinct and every interest that basically supports his rationale for continuing to support the Assad regime. I would say, in terms of, by the way, in Jordan, the Jordanians are in a bit of a pickle, and it's actually self-inflicted to some extent. Obviously the Jordanians are being pressured by different sides to take specific positions, especially from Saudi Arabia, which would like to see the Jordanians take a more enhanced military role inside Syria. What the Jordanians have done is that it's basically it has become a participant in the Syrian civil war and contributing to combating Sunni militants in Iraq. They are currently training Iraqi forces in special operations and counterterrorism. So on both fronts, on both Syria and Iraq, the Jordanians are involved in helping moderates defeat the more extremist elements of the insurgencies in both theaters. So basically, this creates a strategic logic for blowback. At some point, you're going to see, you're likely to see, actually, that those extremist elements are going to retaliate against the Jordanians. In the same sense that what happened in 2005 when the Jordanians were helping the Americans in Iraq counter Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Iraq group. What happened is that they received blowback from that instance in the 2005 bombings on their hotels. So I can actually see a scenario where that's actually repeated, and for the first time, I'm beginning to actually hear Jordanians start talking about ways to prepare in terms of where they're going to, for example, where they're going to spend their summers, where they're going to how they're going to where they're going to put their money, where they're going to shift their investments. So there is a sort of a reaction you're beginning to see, especially after the fall of Mosul. And by the way, when I'm looking at Iraq, and what this makes this so complicated for U.S. foreign policy in terms of dealing with the crisis, is that it's not necessarily ISIS that is actually doing all this. ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Levant, is actually the tip of the spear. This is actually a wider Sunni insurgency. You have different groups as part of this, both militants and as well as secular Baathists. So to actually try to combat this, you would actually be the air force in terms of airstrikes. You would actually be the air force of the Iraqi government going up against the Sunni insurgents. And this is not necessarily particularly against terrorists. This is more of the Sunni community. It's beginning to sort of engulf the Sunni community, which many of them are actually fighting in terms of a political deal, in terms of getting Maliki out of power, and in terms of actual of gaining a stake in the future of Iraq.
Well, Ramzi Mardini, I appreciate your time with us, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ramzi Mardini, who's a non-resident fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. He's based in Amman, Jordan, is also an adjunct fellow at the Beirut-based Iraq Institute for Strategic Studies, and was previously a Middle East analyst at the Center for Strategic Studies at the University of Jordan. From 2010 to 2011, he served at the White House within the office of the National Security Advisor to the Vice President, and in 2006 was on the Iraq desk at the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. He is the editor of Volatile Landscape, Iraq and its Insurgent Movements. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Tea Party Republicans trying to shut down the Export-Import Bank. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and the author of The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. And his latest article at Politico is Why Big Business Fears the Tea Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And in terms of big business fearing the Tea Party, you have all this ideological confusion going on right now on Capitol Hill as these Tea Party Republicans in the House try to kill the Import-Export Bank. And that, of course, goes back to the early days of FDR's New Deal. And then you've got liberal Democrats joining with right-wing Tea Party populists, and you've got the Chamber of Commerce working with Nancy Pelosi. So what's going on here?
Well, both parties are divided among those who have a kind of populist vision of the economy as one organized around small enterprises and a suspicion of large corporations and large entities of any kind, and another wing which frankly understands that modern industrial capitalism requires large oligopolistic corporations and government agencies and big research in the form of universities. So this is a divide that splits both the Democrats and the Republicans. You have the small is beautiful left united against big corporations with the libertarian, populist, Jeffersonian right. Now, where the big corporation is a purely parasitic entity, where it adds little or no value to the economy, like many big banks, there's a case to be made against so-called crony capitalism and government bailouts and so on. The big mistake in the case of the Ex-Im Bank is that it's really a critical tool in promoting American manufacturing. It does so indirectly by allowing foreign purchasers of American goods and products, including things like airplanes from Boeing and other U.S. manufacturers, to receive the lending that they would not otherwise receive. For example, they may be in kind of politically risky countries in Africa. And this is an indirect subsidy to American manufacturing, but it's necessary because we're competing as a nation and not just as individuals with other national government business combinations, which will monopolize foreign export markets because they subsidize their own producers through their own export-import banks, but also through much more direct methods, which the United States does not even have. For example, state-owned enterprises, as in China, or direct equity shares in major corporations, something that you have in Europe. Now, since the United States is 4% of the world population and less than a fifth of the world economy, and almost all of the growth in the world economy is going to take part outside of our borders, we need to have a share in those markets if we're not going to simply have an ever-shrinking share of the world economy. And like it or not, for the foreseeable future, the other industrial nations of Europe and Asia do not play by small government free market rules.
Once again, the ubiquitous Koch brothers are behind some of this effort in the House, with their Tea Party representatives pushing to literally not renew the charter of the Import-Export Bank. But of course, some of the Koch brothers' subsidiaries have applied for import-export bank loans. But just to pull back for a moment here, Michael, and give us a full picture of the ideological consistency or inconsistency on the populist right about subsidies themselves. Don't a lot of these Congress people come from rural districts that are subsidized through agricultural subsidies, ethanol, etc., you name it? Not that the Kochs are in favor of ethanol.
Well, the Republican Party's base today is the South and the West, which was created in its modern form by the federal government during the New Deal and afterwards, with rural electrification, crop subsidies, the interstate highway system, which created Walmart, by the way. Their whole business model, they sprang up in poor rural southern areas at highway intersections, and not least the so-called gun belt of the South and the West, because Southern Democrats like Lyndon Johnson and Mendel Rivers of South Carolina Mississippi spread federal defense contracts all through the South and the West. In the 1950s, the novelist William Faulkner observed that the economy of the South was the federal government. So there is a huge inconsistency between the Southern Tea Party Jeffersonians and their kind of Jeffersonian populism is itself a Southern tradition, and the reality that the economy of the South, perhaps more than that of the more developed commercial industrial regions of the U.S., is dependent on the federal government. And we saw this in the battle in the Mississippi over Thad Cochran's reelection, which essentially pitted a member of Congress who brought home federal contracts and federal subsidies to one of the poorest states in the Union against a Tea Party radical who is against any government whatever. So you can make the case on principle, but you know there is a certain false consciousness, if you want to use a Marxist word, with Southerners and Westerners whose economy is more dependent on federal aid than that of the industrial Northeast, you know, to be denouncing the evils of government aid to business and industry.
And of course, since Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, was defeated in this upset primary recently by a Tea Party insurgent who ran against Wall Street and crony capitalism, the same refrain we have in this debate over the Import-Export Bank that's going on now. I mean, I take it that what you're concerned about now is that it would be disastrous if right-wing populists, while assaulting genuine crony capitalism, were to kill off the productive economy, which can flourish only in partnership with the public sector.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's a distinction that progressives need to make as well. You know, simply idealizing small business versus big business and big banking, there are certain sectors which are imperfect markets by nature, manufacturing, high-tech pharmaceuticals, things like that, where because they're imperfect markets, the natural efficient form of organization is an oligopoly or a monopoly, and you don't want it to run amok. You want it either regulated or enlisted in the national interest. But there's a reason why the global aerospace market for large-body jets is a duopoly. Two companies control most of the world market, Boeing and Airbus, and they do so in part by government procurement, in the case of the Defense Department buying a big chunk of Boeing's output, and also you know subsidies of various kinds and ownership stakes in the case of Airbus. So you know, if you want to be represented in these concentrated, extremely expensive, capital-intensive manufacturing sectors, then you're going to have giant national and global corporations based in your country, and you're also going to need them to be able to retaliate against subsidies from the other side. That's just the world we live in, and it's just a fantasy to imagine that in these particular sectors, not in other sectors. If you want to open up your own health food restaurant, there are no economies of scale there. A mom-and-pop health food restaurant is just as efficient and effective as a national chain. But there's a reason why we don't have 2,500 mom-and-pop aerospace manufacturers or container ship builders. In fact, because of the economies of scale involved in these advanced manufacturing industries, in theory, it's possible for a single company in a single country to make all of the aircraft of the world, or all of the iPhones, or all of the ships. And for national security reasons and reasons of economic diversification and growth, governments intervene to prevent this. So if you simply remove all government interference in the case of the United States, unless the same Tea Party activists are going to convince the Communist Party of China and the bureaucrats of the European Union to remove their subsidies simultaneously, what you'll get is simply a collapse of that American industry, and that market will be monopolized by mercantilist Europeans and state capitalist Chinese.
Of course, the other argument in favor of the Import-Export Bank is that it actually made money for the Treasury. It gave the Treasury over $1 billion last year, I understand.
Well, the Tea Party conservatives argue against that. They've come up with something called fair value accounting, which says that the Export-Import Bank and other government corporations with implicit backing from the federal government, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, have artificially low interest rates because the rest of the world knows that the federal government will bail them out. Now, that's true. But the problem with this fair value accounting is the reason why you have these government agencies doing this kind of credit provision in the first place is that in their absence, contrary to what the libertarian right says, you probably wouldn't have those functions fulfilled at all. So before you had Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie Mae and the other agencies in the U.S., there was no private market for low-interest loans to the vast majority of working-class middle Americans. There simply wasn't. So there was a market failure, which these institutions like the Ex-Im Bank and others too, like the federal housing agencies, fill. And if you get rid of these agencies, it's not going to be filled by private credit. People are going to do without.
Well, just in terms of politics, I've always been amazed at the political left in this country, that they didn't pick up on the bailout of Wall Street after the near-death experience of the global economy brought about by the ridiculous and criminal behavior on Wall Street, all of which they were entirely rewarded for by the taxpayer and made whole as Main Street languishes ever since. And as you know, it was the Tea Party that ran away with this issue. And I'm wondering if in many ways the left still hasn't figured out what it stands for, and if going forward there's any kind of left-right coalition that can be formed out of these issues so that there's some kind of ideological consistency. But that won't happen until somebody enunciates it, will it?
Well, it also won't happen until most of the progressive groups stop taking most of their money from billionaires in the financial sector, including Tom Steyer, who is now calling the shots on environmental policy for much of the left. You know, basically, if you look at going back to Robert Rubin in the 1990s, I'm not the only one who thinks this. A lot of the financial interests that have become more important in funding the Democratic Party and the progressive left have discovered that by focusing on social issues and on environmental issues, which are perfectly legitimate issues, you know, then suddenly a lot of attention and energy is diverted from questions about the sources of their own wealth, right, in a rigged, overly financialized economic system. So I think that's a big barrier, right? You know, where is the think tank in Washington, even the New America Foundation? I don't think we could raise money for this if we tried to. You know, that's focused on, you know, getting rid of the hedge fund loophole and so on. You know, there's vast amounts of money pouring in from finance industry people like Pete Peterson to cut Social Security on the right, from Tom Steyer, you know, to address global warming on the left. Would Tom Steyer or some of these other liberal billionaires pour a lot of money into fixing Wall Street? I mean, maybe there will be, you know, a particular individual who will do this. But I think the funding model of the center-left is essentially to raise money from billionaires, mostly in the finance sector or in the Silicon Valley tech sector, where if the Silicon Valley people are essentially IP royalty rentiers. That is, you know, they're what they would like to do is just rake in rents from their copyrights and patents as long as possible, long after they invented something useful 10 or 20 or 30 years ago.
Right. Plus, monetize your personhood. I mean, let's face it, they're making money out of you and me. We aren't making any money out of us as commodities.
Yeah, but getting back to your question, I think if you had the kind of the other left, which has dwindled in the U.S., is the labor left and the industrial unions. And the industrial unions never had any problem with big business as long as it was big productive business that would employ industrial workers. So they were all in favor of automobile makers. They just wanted to share the profits. And they were all in favor, and to this day, they're in favor of infrastructure. They tend to oppose the green left on things like Keystone. So I think there's a natural alliance between the productive economy types on the center left, and if you could find their equivalents on the center right. And the real division, it should not be between big and small corporations. It should be between industries. It should be between productive industries and purely parasitic industries.
But what about just in terms of humanity, if I can be so portentous here, and if Steyer, who has apparently made a lot of money out of coal, even though he's divesting himself from coal and running now as a green anti-coal, pro-solar and wind activist, he's spending his money to stop global warming, which is a very real thing. And on the other hand, the other examples you gave on the right, Pete Peterson wants to get rid of Social Security, which would have a detrimental impact on every retiree in America. I mean, can't you make your decisions on what is best for the planet and best for humanity?
Well, here's the problem with having liberalism degenerate into what Mike Konzel calls pity charity liberalism. There's a fundamental difference between a liberal movement that is focused on the short-term issues and also the long-term issues of the working class in particular countries, you know, like the Social Democrats in Sweden or the Labor Party in Britain or the New Deal Democrats in the United States, and the priorities of super-rich philanthropists. And I'm all in favor of philanthropy. It's a great feature of our system. But, you know, if you're a billionaire and you ask yourself, you know, what can you most do to help the human race? It may be doing some very worthwhile things, like you know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett teaming up to get rid of malaria in Africa or something like that. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's fine. But that is charity. That is philanthropy. That is not a social democratic working people's movement, which should be focused on things like good jobs and good wages and expanding Social Security and paid family leave and all of that. And that was my only point. You know, mm-hmm. That is, if the money for your so-called left party comes from the super rich who see themselves as citizens of the world, and their chief concern, it may be totally legitimate concern, maybe saving the Amazon, right, or eradicating childhood poverty in Southeast Asia, that is not the program for a center-left national political party or movement.
Yeah, but just in closing, if we have a broken government, which we do, and given that nothing seems to get done in Washington, somebody needs to do something here in terms of you know, if you can't get legislation through, then the philanthropists have to step in.
Well, my point on global warming is the same one I made about subsidies from Europe and Asia. The United States is emitting fewer greenhouse gases than it has since 2007. According to the Energy Information Agency, the U.S. will have below its 2007 peak of greenhouse gases all the way up to the 2030s, mainly because of substituting natural gas, which has half as much CO2, for coal and electricity generation. If the United States has zero emissions tomorrow, the atmosphere is still likely to be heated up because of the activities of China and India alone. So, you know, this is primarily a diplomatic goal and a technological one. If you're really concerned about global warming, then you should be trying to get the Chinese and Indians to switch from burning coal for electricity to burning natural gas as a temporary measure. I know fracking's controversial, but it does radically reduce greenhouse emissions. And then you can work on your non-zero-sum, your zero-carbon energy alternative, whatever it is, for the future, whether it's renewables or nuclear, which is also should be part of the mix. But what you can't do, it's purely symbolic, expressive, self-defeating politics and policy to say we Americans are going to significantly address climate change unilaterally without the Chinese and the Indians being part of some kind of common agreement. I don't know if that addresses your question.
Yeah, but without being argumentative, there's some real questions about methane seepage in terms of fracking and whether it offsets the advantage of burning natural gas.
Every energy source has trade-offs.
Well, Michael, I appreciate the conversation. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and the author of The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, and his latest article at Politico is Why Big Business Fears the Tea Party. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by the Academy Award-nominated filmmaker of the new documentary feature, Citizen Coke. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Carl Diehl, an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker who previously worked as an international news producer and writer. His films include Trouble the Water, which is the winner of the Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize, and he was the co-producer of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, Bowling for Columbine, and Capitalism, A Love Story. His new film, co-directed and produced with Tia Lesson, is Citizen Coke, which opens in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle this weekend, as well as 15 other cities nationwide. Details are available at citizencoke.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Diehl.
Thank you, Ian. It's a thrill to be here.
And your film has been underway for some time, and quite a lot of the film takes place in Madison, Wisconsin. In many ways, it's framed around the great battle for the recall. And now we're learning, of course, from the courts. Governor Walker managed to get the right-wing judge to essentially block this inquiry into the John Does involved in election chicanery.
That's right.
And now that the court documents have been released, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of culpability, including an email that Governor Walker sent to Karl Rove, of all people, extolling or bragging about his friend RJ, who was running the local Wisconsin chapter of the Club for Growth. So it sort of explodes that idea of these outside financial dark money groups being independent. And there's the smoking gun. So
that's right.
I imagine you're feeling somewhat vindicated.
Well, yeah, look, we followed what interested us on the ground, and we took on a big undertaking with this film because we wanted to understand the political landscape after the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which basically said it paved the way for billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited money in elections, as your listeners all know. what was happening, what drew us to Wisconsin was seeing how this dark money gets deployed. It was seeing the political operations of folks like Charles and David Koch, the billionaire industrialists who spend a lot of money on right-wing causes. And, you know, so that's the journey that we want to take people on. In fact, one of the groups, Americans for Prosperity, which was founded by Charles and David Koch, was a major player in the recalls. And their name surfaces in these documents that were just recently released.
Well, one of the things that seems to be consistent here is that Scott Walker is a bit of a doofus, isn't he? I mean, he doesn't seem to be the brightest bulb because he got stung by that hoax from a phony, an actor pretending to be one of the Koch brothers.
And right.
That whole phone conversation went viral. And he comes across as being kind of an earnest doofus, you know. And then in these emails, he's bragging about an illegal activity. I mean, am I right in suggesting that he may not be the brightest bulb?
He may not be the brightest bulb, you know, but he's also, you know, he knows who his audience is. I think, isn't that always the downfall of people on the right is they get arrogant and they think they can do whatever it is that they want to do.
And or whatever the people that are paying them want to be done.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, should politicians be accountable to their constituents? Maybe. But in this case, you know, it's big money coming from out of state that really has been propping Scott Walker up. And he's been implementing an agenda that's developed outside of the state of Wisconsin without any regard for how it affects ordinary working Americans or ordinary working Wisconsinites, let's say.
So what then explains the defeat in the recall? I mean, apart from the fact that structurally it was a pretty screwy system. Yeah. Where you had to end up with the same guy that ran the last time as his opponent who had already lost once to him, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Mayor Tom Barrett, kind of a uninspiring, you know, mainstream Democrat, the mayor of Milwaukee, who couldn't win the backing of the National Democratic Party in that race. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the best way to it's hard to take the dark money out of an election after it's already happened. But one of the things that we saw happening day to day is people were hammered with a message and with many messages. And one of the messages was that the recall is not the Wisconsin way, that a recall election is anti-democratic. And, you know, there was over $1 million spent pushing that particular message out. And so, you know, does that sway voters? If nothing else, it sort of muddles the public conversation about mm-hmm. what the issues are. And so I think that the messaging had a lot to do with it. And also Scott Walker was very visible. And not only did he have to promote his agenda, promote the fiction that Wisconsin was in dire financial straits unless they broke the unions, but he got support from people like the Club for Growth and Americans for Prosperity in promoting that issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the pathetic campaign against the Koch brothers is sort of, to my mind, it indicates the difference between liberals and conservatives. Liberals would rather be righteous than effective. I mean, it's sort of, you know, nice guys finish last type of propaganda, whereas the other guys go for the jugular and get the job done, and that seems to be the case.
It does seem to be the case, but, you know, I don't want to let the Democrats off the hook because they, you know, they play the same game. Mm-hmm. They're just not as good at it. You know, I think in a strange way, Ian, that the folks on the Republican side envy what the folks on the Democratic side can do. You know, like organized labor, for example, they're mm-hmm. really good at doing real grassroots organizing and get out the vote efforts.
Right.
And the Democrats, you know, they're facing this big money juggernaut and they need to figure out how to deal with that. And they're billionaires on, you know, on the liberal side who are backing the Democrats, and it's bad for all of us.
Right. So let's turn to the overall film, because it's not entirely about Wisconsin, but that's sort of the frame in a way. These brothers who had extraordinary influence over American politics. I just the other day spoke with a young activist who infiltrated their secret meeting down here in Dana Point last weekend. Something like 300 billionaires showed up and they pledged $500 million, which to them is chump change, right, to win the Senate for the Republicans in November, and another $500 million to make sure that Hillary Clinton never becomes president. So this is something new. Obviously, Citizens United has enabled it. But I'm just curious, how do these guys get away with it? Because one of the reasons that dark money is so popular amongst the plutocrats, particularly corporate types, is that you don't have to have your name on it.
Right.
And if you have a consumer product, then half your customers are Democrats and half your customers are Republicans. So you're going to piss off one or the other. Yet the Cokes own Dixie Cup. They own Brawny Paper Towels. You name it. All these consumer products that literally fund the Koch brothers in order to have them fund our politics to take away the rights of American citizens and basically get rid of government so that we are entirely at the mercy of these plutocrats. That is their overall agenda. And yet, I don't understand why people buy their products.
Why people buy their products, and why don't people know who they are? You know, that's interesting that they're flying under the radar, and that's by design. They like to be known as philanthropists. You know, they give money to hospitals. They just gave, I think it was $24 million to the United Negro College Fund last week, which
that
was interesting.
That was down in Dana Point, right? The guy that... he's getting some flack for that, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, to me, charity is charity, but I think charity, when most of the money you spend is to rig the system to enhance your bottom line, is suspect. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they do, and look, they're not the only people doing it, spending money on these political nonprofits like Americans for Prosperity and calling that charity, that shouldn't fly.
I see. And that's, of course, that's the rubric under which they operate, that these 501c4s are social welfare vehicles.
Exactly.
And, of course, that explains these why the Republicans are going after the IRS, because they just want to intimidate them into not tinkering with this, obviously, system that's being so flagrantly abused.
That's right. That's right. And but there are rare cases. You know, just what's happening, as you mentioned, in Wisconsin right now, where... Scott Walker was caught colluding with these outside groups, you know, mm-hmm. helping them with the messaging. There's the famous prank phone call that Ian Murphy made from the Buffalo Beast, mm-hmm. where we get to hear what it sounds like when a sitting governor thinks he's speaking to one of his patrons. Right. And what Governor Walker told the fake David Koch was, this is the message that we need to send out in these districts in support of these candidates who are, or these legislators who are likely to face recall. You know, and these activities are, you know, they're clearly designed to circumvent existing election law. And it's just a sign of how permissive the environment is post Citizens United.
But, Kyle Deal, you just said that the reason that the Cokes get away with it is one, and why people continue to buy Brawny. I mean, you know, conservatives are perfectly happy to buy their products, I'm sure. But there's at least half the electorate votes Democrat.
Right.
And Harry Reid, the leader of the Democratic Senate, is railing against the Cokes because he knows how much money they're spending on Mitch McConnell to keep him in there, and he knows that he could lose the majority if their money bears fruit in this upcoming election. So there's no question that the reality is that we know what they're getting away with, but when I ask you why is it that people still buy their products, particularly Democrats and progressives and liberals, you said, you know, people don't know enough about them. And so is that what this film's about, an attempt to educate the public about who these guys are?
Sure, sure. You know, I think, you know, first you need to be informed in order to act. And that's one role that documentary films can play. And it's one of the reasons why we've been pushing so hard to get this film out there. And, you know, strategically, we believe that playing it in the cinema, for starters, is a good way to start building that foundation so that the film can have some legs. And look, we're coming up on a really important midterm election. And as you pointed out, the Democrats are running every race against David and Charles Koch, not against the other candidates. And so,
by the way, is that fair? David and Charles Koch, really, are they buying just about everybody in terms of the Republicans?
It doesn't really matter. I mean, I think they're symptomatic of the bigger problem. Their motives are I would say, impure. Yeah. They're spending their political capital, their money, to enhance their bottom line. You know, you can talk a lot about, you know, whether they're promoting their ideology of libertarianism, but at the end of the day, you know, it's all the same. It increases their reach.
Well, you know, what's interesting about I think it was David Koch did an interview, a very softball interview with a local paper in Kansas, is it?
Charles did in Wichita, yeah.
Yeah, Wichita, yeah, Kansas. Yeah. Charles Koch, yeah. And a listener sent it to me suggesting that he wasn't such a bad guy. And I read it carefully, and it does seem that he's trying to claim that they're against crony capitalism, which is what the guy that just beat Eric Cantor ran on. And that's a very noble idea, but I don't recognize the difference between what they're trying to do to pass laws that increase their bottom line, that remove environmental protections so they can make more money and pollute at the same time.
Right.
Isn't that the same form of crony capitalism where you buy your politicians to do your bidding?
Sure, sure. And what's more insidious, yes, and what's more insidious about it, I think, is along the way, they're changing the way that voters understand those really important issues that affect our lives every day through this constant messaging.
By the way, that was the theme of all of the meetings that took place last weekend down in Dana Point, the secret meeting of the 300 billionaires organized by the Koch brothers. All of the seminars were about messaging.
Right.
I mean, one of them was on global warming. They had no scientists. No. But it was all about how to message. In other words, don't talk about climate change, but talk about energy independence.
Right.
You know.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it's clever. This stuff is really well thought out. And look how successful they've been at planting enough of a seed of doubt in the minds of the people who report the news that people feel obliged to you know, despite, you know, what science tells us, people report that there may be a question about whether the planet is warming and man is causing it. You know, it's right. Effective. They get a lot of bang for their buck.
Well, that's because you can exploit this ridiculous convention we have in the media where in the universe of discourse, there's only two black and white opinions, and you've got to have either or, and you have, for every, you know, if you have a Democrat on, you have to have a Republican on.
That's right.
And if you have a Holocaust survivor on, you're therefore required to have a Holocaust denier on.
Right.
And if you have a scientist on talking about global warming, you've got to have a denier. And if you have, you know, a biologist on, you have to have some creationist on.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's allowed anti-intellectualism to explode onto the national stage.
It's one of the reasons why in this film we looked for mainstream, you know, lifelong Republicans to state their case, people who are left out of the conversation. Because, you know, Republicans don't only exist inside the Beltway or in the Tea Party rallies. You know, there are a lot of people in middle America who, you know, have common values with you and me and who believe in something for a reason. And they feel like what they're seeing happening is their party has been corrupted by money. Now, you know, you could argue that the Republican Party was corrupted by money long ago. But
well, no, I wouldn't, because I know the Democrats are being corrupted by money. And in fact, it's worse in the case of the Democrats because they pretend to stand up for the working person in this country. They have a dilemma. They get their votes from regular working Americans, but they get their money from the same guys that the Republicans do. So, I say a plague on all the houses, and you have to clean up. You know, you need a new sheriff in town. You got to clean up this mess. And isn't that what you're trying to do with this film?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because when that big money comes in and influences the outcome of an election, we all lose. Cause it even limits who's willing to run, who can throw their hat in the ring.
Right.
You know, so it limits the pool of viable candidates, you know.
Well, I know she, in terms of Republicans, I know you have Buddy Romer, who tried to run for president in the last election. And they kept rigging the game against him. He couldn't get into the Republican debates.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't have your voice heard, if you can't reach the electorate, and when you're running for president, you're talking to the nation. And if you can't stand on that stage during the, I don't know what they had. It seemed like they had 100 debates in 2012 with that rolling clown show. But, you know, they kept raising the bar on Buddy on the requirements to get in. And this guy is a former governor. He's a former U.S. congressman. He's a Republican, moderate Republican, but he's a Republican. And, you know, by all measures, he seemed to belong on that stage. And they kept raising the bar, saying that you needed to have raised a certain amount of money in the last 30 days in order to stand on that stage.
So, isn't that interesting, though, that you measured by how much money you raised as opposed to how many voters that would sign a petition in your support.
And especially, exactly, and the issue that he wanted to talk about was exactly this, the corrupting influence of money in politics and in elections. And, you know, the folks who made those decisions didn't want to have that conversation.
Well, tell me then, in the last few minutes, Kyle Deal, about your new film, Citizen Coke. What are you hoping to, I mean, we mentioned the need to educate people about who these billionaires are. I think their combined wealth is something like $800 million or something. Yeah. Billion, $100 billion.
$100 billion. I think it was 104 yesterday.
104.
I mean, you can watch the ticker.
They had a good day.
Right?
Okay, so, and these guys aren't responsible for everything, but they're somewhat the poster boys for the oligarchical takeover of American democracy. Yeah. And it's well underway. So what are the steps here? See the film. Take to the streets? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's take to the streets. Let's bring about some change. You know, I think that, you know, it feels kind of hopeless when you look at that mountain to climb, you know, those billions of dollars that are getting deployed into the political process. But I think it's important to remember that the reason that they spend that kind of money is that they're afraid of voters. You know, they're afraid of people who have the same power that they do. At least, you know, Brian, the corrections officer in our film, says it, you know, in that one moment of time, the guy living in the mansion down the street and the guy under the cardboard box have the same rights and the same power. And so, you know, it's that that engagement in the political process, I think, that's going to be really important, and holding our leaders accountable. We're filmmakers, so we don't have that kind of access, and we don't have all those solutions, but there are a lot of people who do. One thing we're doing at a lot of our events is we're partnering with groups like Move to Amend, who are working to undo the damage that Citizens United has done, and we want to be sure that we give people something to do if they come out of the movie and they want to engage, you know. But look, the most important thing I think that a film can accomplish is immeasurable. There's an internal dialogue that happens when you're, you know, part of an emotional story, and hopefully you're changing the way people understand the world, and who knows how they might act.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio, Kyle Deal.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks so much for everything you do.
And again, I've been speaking with Kyle Deal, who's an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker who previously worked as an international news producer and writer. His films include Trouble the Water, which was the winner of the Sundance Film Festival's Grand Jury Prize, and he was the co-producer of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, Bowling for Columbine, and Capitalism, A Love Story. His new film, co-directed and produced with Tia Lesson, is Citizen Coke, and it opens in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and 15 other cities this weekend, and details are available at citizencoke.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.